Hey everybody, we're back. We have commandeered the show. We have still commandeered it. Like I said before, we are like the movie Pirates of the Caribbean, and I am like Jack Sparrow, Captain Jack Sparrow. So we are running the show today. Our circle of influence has kind of expanded a little bit. There's Uncle Mike in back. Say hi, Uncle Mike. Right, Uncle Mike is like the character Walter from Jeff Dunham. And Uncle Mike, say something positive.
I'm the best that there is.
Uncle Mike is the best that there is. And to my right is second year MA2 student Melody Kwok. Directly kind of in front of me at my 1 or 2 o'clock is recent graduate of our Master of Athletic Training program, Nicole Kasha. To my left is Hajime Takashima, athletic trainer extraordinaire and baseball guru. And to my immediate left is Dr. Tunis. And Dr. Tunis is a wrist and hand specialist, mm-hmm. Right?
Yes.
So let's get into it. I'm Dr. Josh Yellen, director of the Master of Athletic Training program at the University of Houston. If you want to look us up, we're at hhp.uh.edu/MAT. Again, that's www.hhp.uh.edu/MAT. For this episode, you can look at www.sportsmedicinebroadcast.com and look up Dr. Tunis's name, Candace Tunis, spelled T-E-U-N-I-S. So again, that's sportsmedicinebroadcast.com slash Candace Tunis 2016. So Dr. Tunis, your specialty, let's kind of go back in time a little bit. And you are originally from where?
I'm originally from Arlington, Virginia.
Uh-huh.
Not to be confused with Arlington, Texas. I'm
pretty
much right outside of Washington, D.C.
And I'm assuming you're there because your family was associated with the FBI and the CIA.
We can neither confirm nor deny.
Yeah, that's fine. I totally get that. And I like the way how fast you jumped on that. I totally get it.
If I told you, then
I'd have to
bad
die.
Might happen,
I totally get it. I think my father-in-law is part of the mob, so I've been part of that family for 18 years, and I still think he's going to whack me one day. Okay, and then from there, that's where you're from, and where'd you go to undergraduate?
I went to undergraduate at Princeton. I played golf for Princeton.
Well, I can't.
Good Lord.
Yeah, I mean, that Ivy League education, yeah, I mean, that's it. It's over. We're over. We're done.
Yeah.
What's the mascot for Princeton?
The tiger.
Right. And so it's the Princeton Tigers, and we played golf. I'm a huge fan, by the way, of the Ivy League education and the liberal arts education. Unfortunately, we don't do enough on our part in education to help people think in the Ivy League education.
That's kind of their whole thing.
Well,
they teach you how to think about stuff. Well, I didn't have a practical education at all.
Well,
I studied
okay.
dolphins.
No, that's fine. But, you know, the deal is this, is that I've always said, have you ever noticed that, like, some of the people around the world that are making some really big decisions about the world, they all come out of this kind of Ivy League education, right? And one of the reasons why is because the Ivy League education teaches you to think and solve problems. There's something called this Yale six-step process mm-hmm. of problem solving. I'm a huge fan of that, huge fan, but that's not why we're here. So then from Princeton, you went to medical school?
Emory in Atlanta.
This is incredible. And then, so you went to medical school. It's a 4-year degree. You should probably graduate in 2.
Stop.
And then then you did your residency.
Need to lock it up here soon.
Yeah, you did your residency in?
At the University of Utah for orthopedics.
Yeah, you did. All right. So you went skiing a little bit.
Just a tad. I can neither confirm nor deny that
I totally
skied
get it.
Residency.
And then, so you did Utah, and then you did a fellowship.
Yes, I went to San Antonio to study hand surgery with Dr. Green, whose
uh-huh.
name happens to be on, like, Green's hand surgery textbook, and so
yep.
he's...
That guy. Yeah, I totally get it. You know, when your mentor and preceptor wrote their own textbook, that's...
It's not too shabby.
No, not at all. So let's talk about your specialty, and really today's talk was about ulnar side wrist pain.
Mm-hmm.
What's so important, right, for everybody that's listening in our audiences, you know, maybe physical therapists, maybe athletic trainers, maybe sports medicine professionals, sports scientists, etc., right? We've got the TFCC, we've got some other things, but really kind of get into why the ulnar side is so important.
I think the owner side of the risk is just a difficult one to examine. You know, when I, and as I kind of mentioned in the talk in there, when people come in and say that my wrist sort of just hurts, one way to help narrow it down is to have them divide it between the thumb side and the pinky side, because it really changes your diagnoses, it changes your approach to it. And the ulnar side of the wrist, I think, is just quite complicated. You know, you can have nerve problems that can cause issue. Obviously, there's trauma to ligaments and tendons, and that's why I focused on that for the talk today, just because I think it can be a bit of a black box of problems, and so to try to give some systematic a way of systematically approaching the ulnar aspect of the wrist so that, you know, you're aware of these other things that can kind of cause pain on that side.
And so let's just to kind of orientate everybody, right? I'm a big mnemonic type person. So when we're memorizing the carpals,
right,
everybody knows the same mnemonic.
Right.
And what is that mnemonic?
Are you really going to make me say that?
Some lovers try positions that they can't have.
Okay, I mean, let's just, I'm really glad that somebody else.
Yeah, let's just put it out there. And so let's go through a clinic. It's like the same thing for the cranial nerves. We have a G-rated version, and then we have a not G-rated
version. Same thing
version.
For the growth centers of the elbow.
I'm not. Want it? Please.
No.
Yes.
Oh,
all right.
No.
So
after the podcast.
Okay.
I'll tell
well,
you.
We never shut down, so it's either I mean you're either in or you're out. I'm just telling you. All right. So let's go through kind of clinical anatomy for everybody that's listening. Obviously, everybody can identify the scaphoid.
Right.
Everybody can identify the lunate.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody can identify the capitate.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody can identify the pisiform, and everybody can identify the hamate. It's the three T's that get confusing.
Yes.
So can you kind of, you know, when you're verbally going through for everybody that's listening and everybody that's going to watch, can you kind of demonstrate on Haji's hand your clinical, you know, how you evaluate and name the bones while you're
doing. So this the beauty of, and this is what I was kind of, it's hard to sort of gain this from a big lecture hall talk, but you know, you can be fairly specific about the anatomy when you're looking at the wrist. You know, you, rather than just saying, okay, well, it's just sort of like hurt here, you know. So, you know, the wrist is, all the bony anatomy is very superficial. I mean, it's right there. So if you're specific with it with one finger, you can really elicit, you know, where people are tender. So, you know, here's the scaphoid. Everybody knows the anatomic snuff box. Then as you kind of come around here, lunate will be, you can feel this soft spot. Lister's tubercle is the prominence here at the end of the distal radius. If you come just a little bit distal to that, you'll pop into really where I give wrist injections. It's an easy way to get into the wrist joint. And that's kind of right between the scaphoid and the lunate. Lunate kind of sits underneath these, you know, this group of tendons that pulls your fingers up, your extensor tendons here. And then as you're coming over to the side, triquetrum is the next one over. So that's one of the T's. And that's a relevant T for pain on this side. So so the triquetrum here is right off the end of the distal ulna. So, you know, this bump on the ulnar aspect of the wrist is the end of the ulna or the ulnar styloid. And if you go just distal to that, basically you'll run into the triquetrum.
Mm-hmm.
And then ECU, you can feel, you know, the ECU tendon will be the next kind of thing over. And you can kind of feel its groove that it sits in. You know, here's one end of the groove, here's the tendon, and then here's the other end of the groove.
Mm-hmm.
And then as you're coming around, this, I think the fovea is easier to feel if you put your elbow on the table and you're kind of coming up, here's the distal ulna, and then if you dip into this soft spot right there, that's the fovea,
mm-hmm.
and that's right where the TFCC is located. And then as you're coming around this side, FCU will be the tendon that's on this side of the wrist, and the pisiform, that's another easy one to remember, it's the only P, you can feel right here, it's usually right at this wrist crease, and it is contained within, it's kind of like the patella of your wrist, it's contained within the FCU tendon, and as you're coming out a little bit distal to that, you can feel the hook of the hamate, you can feel right there in the kind of ulnar heel of the hand. And so the other two T's are more relevant for thumb stuff and trapezoid. Hardly anything ever happens to the trapezoid. So,
and there you go, right? So you've got the triquetrum that we talked about,
yep.
And you've got the trapezoid, and then you've got the
trapezium.
And
the way when I was learning all this stuff, trapezium rhymes with thumb, and it is the one that is next to the thumb. So.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I was in an OR rotation and they were talking about ECU, I was like, it took me a second. I was like, East Carolina University?
Right. No, it's a bad thing. There's so many acronyms. So like, ECU, Extensor Culper on the RS, yeah. And then DREJ is another one.
Yeah, it took me a second. I remember, like, and the orthopedist was like, so this is the ECU? And I'm like, uh-huh.
Uh-huh. Fake it till you make it.
So East Carolina University. Huh? All right, whatever, dude. Okay. Go Beach. I don't know. All right. So then we kind of get into the tendons, right? And walk us through again. We talked about the extensor carpi ulnaris. We talked about the flexor carpi ulnaris. But can you also identify the flexor carpi radialis?
Yeah.
Can you kind of go over for everybody that's watching your clinical presentation, you know, how you go through things?
Yeah, so FCR, or flexor carpi radialis, will be on the, so, you know, everything is named with a purpose. So flexor, so it'll be a flexor. Mm. Carpi, it's moving the wrist. And then ulnar or radial will tell you where it is. So we talked, you know, FCU, or flexor carpi ulnaris, will be on the ulnar aspect. All your flexor tendons for your fingers are kind of in the center, and then FCR will be here. So if you ask somebody to flex their wrist up, so go ahead and flex your wrist up. And so there's your FCR. So FCR for you, and keep it up a little bit more and hold it there. So you resist people's flexion, and that really can kind of help some of these tendons kind of pop out, and also can help elicit, you know, it may elicit some pain. People who have FCU tendonitis, which is right along in here, will tend to have pain when you resist flexion. If you want to test FCU specifically, I didn't really talk about this, but you can have them bring their thumb towards your ring and your small finger and then bring it down, and that really isolates FCU.
Same way you try to get the palmaris longus to pop out.
Right, exactly.
It's just the same way that you try to get the FCU.
Kind of. Rather than all of them together, mm-hmm. FCU is just the ring and the small, and mm-hmm. then bring it down. Mm-hmm. And that's another thing, because the ulnar nerve supplies is the motor for FCU. So if right. you're testing for weakness in FCU because of ulnar nerve problems, it's another.
And so talk about, now that, you know, we're kind of listening and, you know, watching what's happening, talk about just briefly the neurovascular systems of the mm-hmm. wrist. It gets really complicated. I remember I have a cousin that is also a hand specialist. He's at the Medical College of Wisconsin now. Mm-hmm. He did his fellowship training in Loma Linda, mm-hmm. California. Great. And I, you know, I remember him going through the, you know, finishing his residency and then going for a fellowship. And man, the hand is so intricate and it's so complicated. And it takes very precise movements. Because, you know, we have got to use these things quite a bit. Mm-hmm. So talk a little bit about that neurovascular structure that's involved.
So vascular anatomy is fairly simple in the sense that there's two arteries. You have your radial artery, which most everybody can kind of feel that fairly easily. Your ulnar artery is a little bit sometimes harder to feel. It's tucked right underneath FCU. So if you found FCU and you sort of feel underneath that, mm-hmm. you should be able to feel an ulnar artery pulse. But the ulnar artery sometimes just isn't as robust as the radial artery. So sometimes it can be a little harder to feel. But essentially, you have the two arteries, your radial and ulnar artery, come out into the hand where they form these two arches. Mm-hmm. And basically, the hand has an unbelievable blood supply. It's very selfish. That's why it heals well. It makes me look good. You know, mm-hmm. wounds can be really open, and then they still heal in the hand because they have such good blood supply because of the two arteries. And so basically, each artery comes out and forms these two arches. And so when you're doing a vascular exam of the wrist, you can feel each of them. And the ulnar artery specifically will wrap right next to the hook of the handmate. And sometimes this is where you can feel, you know, an aneurysm can form out here, so you'll actually feel like a mass, really, that'll pulse out here in the palm. And I talked about that a little bit. That's hypothenar hammer syndrome, where mm-hmm. people who use their hand like a hammer and they bang on the heel of it can damage the artery there and will form an aneurysm and can mm-hmm. affect blood flow. But an Allen's test is a good way to really differentiate how well each artery is flowing. So you make a fist, squeeze hard, and I'll kind of like help push some of the blood flow out, and then I'll occlude, put my thumbs over each one. Now open your hand, and see, now it's kind of white, and you just mm-hmm. relax your hand, and then I'll let this one fill, and see, here is ulnar mm-hmm. arteries filling in. You can
yeah,
see
sure.
it get pink. So mm-hmm. do it again, make a fist. I'll do that again, and push on both radial artery, go ahead and open and relax your hand, and it's white, and then here comes your radial artery.
And so this is called the Allen test.
Allen's test.
Different than the Allen test for thoracic outlet syndrome, right? Yeah, mm-hmm. Good. Good. I'm glad you, thank you for remembering that, Melanie, whatever. Okay.
And then for the nerves, essentially there's three nerves to the hand, but the radial nerve is not, it's a cutaneous only nerve, so you're really looking at just the median and the ulnar nerve.
Okay.
Median nerve is your carpal tunnel nerve.
Sure.
Travels in the center of the wrist, gives you the motor here to your thenar eminence, the thumb opposition, mm-hmm. And some other muscles, but that's the main one. And then also gives you the feeling to sort of these three and half. The ring finger is kind of, who knows, because it can go either way.
Right.
But essentially this aspect of the hand, these three fingers. Radial nerve will come down here and give you the feeling to the back of the radial aspect of the hand, but no motor. And uh-huh. then ulnar nerve, again, travels with the artery, comes out, travels through Guillain's canal or the ulnar tunnel,
mm-hmm.
And then gives you the feeling here, and then also gives you this motor. So if you spread your fingers out wide and hold it there, or if you point to, like you're pointing to something across the room, this muscle, if you hold it there real strong, you can see that muscle come out. That is your first dorsal interosseous muscle. So that's the one that will waste away if your ulnar nerve is having a problem. So you can kind of, if you look at both hands, you can kind of, compare, muscle here to muscle there, and it'll give you a sense of how thick it is. The other thing, too, is that the ulnar nerve will send a branch out here before it gets to the hand called the dorsal sensory branch of the ulnar nerve, or the DSBUM. We can have another acronym.
Got them all day.
Right? And that gives you the feeling to the back of the hand on the pinky aspect. And that's sort of relevant when you're trying to distinguish if you're looking at an ulnar nerve problem. Is it an ulnar nerve problem at the elbow, by far more common, or at the hand? If it's a problem at the elbow, then you'd expect to have tingling here on the on the back of the hand. If it's localized to the hand, then this should be fine, because it doesn't always work that way.
Right. but I mean, we're talking about differentials and stuff like that. These are some possibilities. So let's kind of take that and start to move into some more common injuries that we start to see in the athletic population, right? Mm-hmm. Let's just throw some scenarios out there. Maybe I've got a avid tennis player.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I've got a 20-year-old baseball player. Maybe I've got a 18-year-old football player. Maybe I've got a gymnast, right? So let's talk about some common injuries that are going to occur in this hand and wrist, because I think, to be honest with you, a lot of practitioners outside of hand specialists, they kind of shy away from the hand because it's really super complicated,
mm-hmm.
right? So let's talk a little bit about that.
So, I think the probably the biggest one for ulnar wrist is going to be the TFCC. I think that's by far the most common sort of athletic injury that you're going to see.
Mm-hmm.
And when I describe what the heck the TFCC is to a patient of mine, I say, well, it's like a combination of a ligament and a cushion on the ulnar aspect of the wrist. And so it gives you some stability. It also gives kind of a cushion. And that can be injured, in a number of different ways. It can be injured. I see it a lot in racket players, tennis mm-hmm. players, because of this motion.
The TFCC.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You can get TFCC tears with that. Just kind of an awkward motion. I've seen it in weightlifting. This can be relevant for any of the
So when you talk about weightlifting, it's that, let's say
clean
we're going to go
jerk.
Into a clean and jerk,
yep. mm-hmm.
right? That snapping
yeah, it's
motion.
Yeah, that snap motion. I've seen that get damaged with that.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen the TFCC get damaged with that. And then just a basic fall, which happens in any sport.
The finch.
Right? Exactly. Yeah. Now, they like to describe, it was fallen, I pronated, and I'm like, I broke my wrist snowboarding. Okay, snowboarding, learning to snowboard.
Uh-huh.
I don't remember exactly how I fell on my wrist. It just fell on my wrist. So,
uh-huh.
If they have a trauma where they fall on the wrist, the TFCC is very vulnerable, with or without a fracture.
Okay.
And then for baseball players, hook a hamate fractures. That's not an uncommon thing because it's a bat. Same thing with golfers. You mm-hmm. hit it bat, or you have an injury where something strikes the bat. You can get a hook of a hamate fracture.
How common are those?
I see it probably one or two a year.
Okay, so not very
not
common.
Very common.
The majority of your practice is taken up when we're talking about. Let me go back to something about the TFCC. How mobile should this segment be?
Depends on the person, which is why the beauty of hand is you have another one. So compare it to the other side, because you know, my wrist, if, you know, especially like your gymnast wrist, is going to be a whole lot looser than a football player's wrist.
Right.
And so, and then also depending on your position of forearm rotation. So you have to be kind of consistent. So, you know, if I'm assessing the – so when you're looking at the TFCC, you have to look at the DREJ. The two are sort of inextricably linked. And so when you're doing this piano key test where you put your thumb on the distal ulna and you push down, there's a normal amount of motion there. Now, his wrist is essentially pronated. If I come into neutral, you'll get a little bit different motion. If you come into supination, typically that's where it's the tightest and it's a little harder to move. So, you know, when you're assessing, you want to assess it in some different positions, and then you compare it to the other side to get a sense of what their normal is, because it will be different for everybody.
Everybody comes out of the factory just different.
Right, exactly. And people will come in, it's so funny, and they'll say, well, this looks really, you know, when they've injured their wrist, and now this looks really big. Well, it probably looks the same as it always is, but nobody ever really notices it.
Right.
But it really depends on the patient. Some people have very prominent distal ulnas, and some people you can hardly see it. So, again, always compare it to the other side.
And so TFCC, very common, right? Mm-hmm. What are some other common injuries that you see?
Well, moving outside of the ulnar aspect of the wrist, scaphoid fractures are really common. And then, you know, ECU tendon issues I'll see, but that's not going to be typically a trauma, although sometimes they can traumatically start to pop out of place.
Really? They kind of sublux back and forth. Mm-hmm. And why do they sublux? It's because the retinaculum is...
Yeah, you tear the retinaculum.
And how would you tear the retinaculum on an ECU?
You know, I can't really.
We stumped a good doctor.
You did. I'm trying to think.
I mean, this is
usually.
I'm just saying. For all those, I'm gonna look at the camera. I went to undergrad at Cal State University Northridge. Okay, my master's degree is from Cal State University Long Beach, and my doctoral degree is from Southeastern Louisiana University. She went to, and I stumped.
Touche.
This is
say.
A California state. That's it.
Done.
Okay.
Mic drop.
That's it. Done.
Honestly, I can't think of it. I mean, a twisting injury of some sort.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, let's move on.
I'm just letting you know that I'm gonna. This was like the highlight of my life, right? So, some other things that we need to know, right? Because, like, for instance, Haji's in baseball, and he's dealing with a lot of upper extremity. He's brilliant at the upper extremity stuff. A lot of elbows, a lot of hands, a lot of wrists. What are some things that you want us to know when we're doing our examination and we're going to communicate with you? It's like, hey, look, this is what I'm seeing. What are some tidbits that you want us to know? Mm-hmm. Did you examine the wrist or the hand?
So, one thing that I think is helpful is to be specific as far with your exam, you know, and try to, and that's helpful to just help kind of narrow down, you know, where their particular pain is. And then and instability, because instability really changes the game. So, okay, they might have a TFCC tear on their MRI. Two questions. Is that where their pain is coming from? Mm-hmm. And what's the DREJ like? So just to use an example, because that really helps to direct treatment, because we could MRI 50 wrists and 30 of them might have a TFCC tear, but it may not be symptomatic. Mm-hmm. And if the TFCC, I guess, kind of like the meniscus, you know, if it's not symptomatic, do you have to do something with it?
Right.
That's debatable.
Right. I like to chunk all these things in. I like to make comparisons. Like we were talking about, I forget what physician was in here. I think it was Dr. Zude. And we were talking about the plica in the knee, and I like to kind of chunk the plica into, you know, what is that also like in other parts of the body? So, you know, the TFCC, well, it's a lot like meniscus. Mm-hmm. If it's not symptomatic, leave it alone.
Yeah, or is it really the pain generator? Because a lot of times, you know, you'll find things on the MRI, is that really the reason? You know, okay, they have a little signal in their scapholunate. Okay, well, are they tender over that? If they're not tender over it, I don't care. You know, and I care, but, you know, not, but it, you can chase down a lot of things on an MRI, and TFCC is one of them. You can have signal in it, it can look a little bit funky, but, you know, if they don't have a lot of foveal tenderness, if they don't have pain with ulnar deviation or weight bearing on in that specific spot, it may not matter. I've seen a lot of ECU. I think the one thing that ECU tendonitis and TFCC, I think sometimes are hard to sometimes know, and that's where history is really helpful. You know, ask them, well, how did it all start? You know, with TFCC injuries, it'll be a moment. Okay, I tweaked my wrist or I caught it on something, and then I had pain.
Yeah.
ECU is like, well, I don't know. I was, you know, doing a whole bunch of back handsprings, and then all of a sudden it kind of started bothering me. Or I was, you know, working on a, you know, new grip for backhand, and then now my wrist hurts. You know, that helps me a lot when I'm trying to narrow down which it is, because the two are very close together. And in fact, the subsheath, the undersheath for the TFCC and for the ECU, excuse me, is part of the TFCC. So they're all kind of they're very closely related. So, you know, doing a good history, a very specific exam, and not sort of letting an MRI always just dictate what needs to be treated, I think are some points that I
would
make.
So we're kind of using our training and our education, and we're making deductive decisions based on the evidence that we're presented. Nicole Kasha has got a question for you. Haji, I'm surprised you're not just bumbling.
Well, I have a bunch of questions.
Well, yeah.
I'm waiting.
So, okay, well, let's go.
Yes. Don't let me drone on.
What would you say are three good differentials for TFCC?
Something going on with the ECU, I think, would be your number one differential. And then, especially if they're coming in with sort of a vague, kind of just kind of crept up and is bothering me, don't forget about the ulnar nerve, because I have definitely seen people who have an ulnar nerve problem at the elbow and just have this weird wrist pain, and they're not really that tender, but it's the problems up here. And so I'd say don't forget about the ulnar nerve. And be, as far as specific really to the ulnar wrist, TFCC and ECU, I think, are the ones that oftentimes I'll have a hard time differentiating. That's really rare. I mean, like an injury where the carpus kind of translates off to the side, that's fairly uncommon. And then LT ligament tears can also cause pain, but those are also fairly uncommon and usually will heal on their own. So
all these tiny little ligaments in the carpals, man. That's why you got to specialize. I imagine what I'm like. I mean, I'm an academic administrator. I listen to you guys, and it's like, when Uncle Mike's over there, he's probably making some faces at me right now.
Maybe.
And then we have another member of your fan club in back of me.
Fan club. This is my sister, actually. Who's
Hi.
Here.
Do you want to join us?
So she can talk about it. She is a collegiate swimmer.
Uh-huh.
California, too.
UCLA.
Where? UCLA?
Yeah.
Long Beach State.
We're kind of peeps.
I was on the medical staff of the Olympic trials in Anaheim.
What year?
2004.
Okay.
Yeah.
It was well before that.
And so
she went to Olympic trials twice. I get to say that.
But you didn't grow up in California.
No, we grew up in Arlington, Virginia.
Yeah, you can't talk about it.
Right?
Don't talk about it. You know, part of my job at University of Houston is that, this is in all reality, is that I assist with the astronaut strength conditioning rehabilitation program at NASA.
Oh, my best friend works at NASA.
Can we talk about that?
Can we talk about it? Yeah.
Well, I got cleared by the FBI. I have a NASA badge, and the FBI cleared me. The FBI. And so, like, all my friends got, my references. I have to have 5 references. And, yeah, of course, they were all going to get into, like, no, don't. The FBI, no, absolutely not. I have pictures from college, and I, no. Right. All right, Haji, you got some.
Yes. Prevention is all about nowadays in sports medicine, athletic training. So you said TFCC, even Fukuhamid fracture, are the biggest or most frequently you can see.
Mm-hmm.
How you can prevent TFCC tear?
That's a good question.
Yes.
I think things that keep. I mean. Flexibility is always important, keeping your, as far as good motion, particularly in rotation. And then I think strength, if I'm sending somebody, but then there's also the spectrum of, especially with like the swimmers and the gymnasts who are almost like kind of too flexible, they have kind of global laxity. And they'll come in sometimes with just vague wrist pain of really no clear cause. And I think for those folks, doing some and really for anybody, you know, strengthening the things that we can impact at the wrist are going to be your wrist flexors, wrist extensors, and then the rotators,
okay.
You know, to try to keep those strong, because those are the only things that you can really change. You can't, you know, I mean, you can't really change. You can't make somebody ligamentously tighter, you know.
Right. Then you talk about, I interrupted you. Talk about this flexibility about...
Mm-hmm.
Distal owner.
Mm-hmm.
So what if I do mobilization about this distal owner, would that help?
So if somebody comes in, you mean like, would if you immobilize it in a position where it might allow it to tighten, is that what you're saying?
Or like, what if it takes to prevent TFCC or any stress at TFCC?
I think I don't know. I mean, other than just to keep the wrist in general mobile, I don't know that doing the specific manipulation across the DREJ is going to change much.
Okay.
Just in general, keeping the wrist mobile and then strengthening the muscles that cross the wrist joint, so your wrist flexors, your wrist extensors, and then also the rotators. I think if you can do rotational strengthening,
mm-hmm.
that'll help to kind of support the DREJ.
Okay.
If that answers your question.
Obviously. Then also, this is just my limited experience, but...
Don't, Haji. Come on.
I'm still novice.
We all are.
Okay. Yeah, we are. We are all learning.
But...
Okay. So I've been diagnosing it. I've been misdiagnosed all the time.
Yeah.
Okay. So one of the biggest is this TFCC. So mm-hmm. I was like, oh, hey, you have TFCC tear.
Mm-hmm.
This must be it. Then I was wrong. Then what was it? Was Hooker Bahamut fracture.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see any correlation between those two?
Not really. I mean, I haven't seen them kind of, you know, Hooker Bahamut is an unusual, as you know, you had asked, it's a fairly unusual injury. It's not usually on people's radar screens, you know. A lot of that is the story as far as how it was hurt.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, some of the same things with baseball players, you can also injure the TFCC. So that TFCC is much more common than the Hooker Bahamut. I think that in that case, from a diagnostic standpoint, it will really come down to where they hurt. You know, and Hooker Bahamut should be
right.
Very tender
there. Right? Off,
yeah,
the TFCC,
it should. TFCC is going to be a little more mm-hmm. proximal.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that being said, in the acute phase, when they hurt it like yesterday, everything hurts.
Sure.
So one of the things that I'll do, because I'll see this a lot during football season, you know, fall concern for scaphoid fracture. You know, and. Sometimes it's really hard. You know, I love to say, well, be specific. Did it hurt here? Well, when they come in and the wrist is all blown up because mm-hmm. they've got it squished between two linemen's helmets, like, it's very hard to help narrow it down. So sometimes I'll just splint it, rest it, see them in a week, and then a lot of times that'll help kind of the, you know, things settle so you can be a little bit more specific.
I think we're kind of coming to a conclusion here real quick. You know, the two times that I saw a hook of the hamate fracture, both in baseball,
mm-hmm.
and it was the butt of the bat.
Yep.
And they got bunched up, you know, ball coming at them, and it was the butt of the mm-hmm. bat that ball smashed it, and it was just that one little contact.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we rested him for a week, and it was after, I was told by one of my mentors, give it 3 days, and it was still tender in that specific spot. 3 days, it's fractured.
Mm-hmm.
Because you got to let that hypothenar surface
right.
just kind of calm down a little bit,
mm-hmm.
and let's see what we can do.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, sure enough, and I remember the first time I saw it, I was surprised. Oh, wow, I've never seen that. And the second time I saw it, I was like, okay, let's see what happens after 3 days. Let that entire inflammatory process go through. It's got to be fractured. Mm-hmm. Do you want to take a picture of it? It's fractured. What do? Rest it. There's not a whole lot we can do.
Well, from a treater standpoint, yeah, there's not much you can do.
Right.
From my standpoint, it's actually one of the easiest things to treat because you just take it out.
Oh, really? You can just take out the hook of the hamate?
Just take it out. You don't need it. So I can just excise where it's usually broken at the base.
It's like the appendix of the hand.
It is the appendix of the hand. There you go. You can also take the pisiform out, too.
It's like the appendix and the gallbladder of the hand.
Right.
That's what it is. Anything else where you're axing off? What else?
You can take the trapezium out. I mean,
we're just hacking stuff away.
Right?
So that's a common procedure for hook of the hamate, but without that, so you don't have ulnar tunnel, like Guillain's tunnel, Guillain.
Guillain, yeah.
What happened to ulnar nerve?
It's a frange.
So what, I have like kind of unstable?
No, actually. And then, you know, so when I was talking about, because, you know, the ulnar nerve can get compressed right there next to the hook of the handmate. Mm-hmm. So really, you're almost decompressing the nerve when you take the handmate out, because you have to open up the ligaments that attach right there that cross over the nerve. So the nerve doesn't become unstable, just like a median nerve does not become unstable when you do a carpal tunnel release. And similarly, you can just take, you and I take out really pretty much right at the base of the, I take it out right at the base of the hook, close up the skin, and once the incision's healed, they can go back to full activity. It's probably one of the fastest recoveries following a fracture in the hand, if not the fastest.
Well, I think we're going to have to wrap it up, because I think we're going to have our next guest coming in. Dr. Tunis, thank you for dropping knowledge. I mean, this is, and let me also tell you this. For a hand surgeon, you're one of the few hand surgeons I know that wear, I wear this Kalo ring, right?
Uh-huh.
But you're one of the few hand surgeons I know that wear
a wedding ring.
A wedding ring. Yeah, most hand surgeons, because of the amount of degloving that you guys
right.
see, and ugh.
It can be ugly,
yeah,
but
I don't want to do that. All right, so if you want to look up this episode on the Sports Medicine Broadcast, it's www.sportsmedicinebroadcast.com. Candace Tunis, spelled T-E-U-N-I-S, 2016. Sportsmedicinebroadcast.com. Candace Tunis, 2016. For the Sports Medicine Broadcast, I'm Dr. Josh Yellen, University of Houston, Master of Athletic Training Program. Thank you for everybody being here. Thank you, Dr. Tunis.
Thank you so much.
Okay, bye.